From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Former President Jimmy Carter can speak in Sunday school tones of peace and love, but in this presidential campaign season, he is often speaking in tones of a fire and brimstone prophet. At the Democratic National Convention, he tore into the Bush administration for shattered American credibility, for extremism in the White House, for what Carter called a radical departure from basic American principles. At 80, Jimmy Carter still monitors elections around the world and has plenty to say about the upcoming U.S. vote. He's also out at 80 with the paperback version of his first novel, a story of the South, of Americans fighting Americans, and the Revolutionary War. Tonight on Point, an intimate conversation on presidential politics and the state of the nation with former President Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter joins me now in the studio. He was 39th President of the United States, winner of the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize. He's chairman of the Carter Center and author now of many books, including the best-selling memoirs An Hour Before Daylight and Christmas in Plains. His best-selling novel, now in paperback, is The Hornet's Nest, a novel of the Revolutionary War. Jimmy Carter, it's wonderful to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Well, it's nice to be back in Boston. Last time I was here was for the convention, and it's always good to come to this race.
And you were fiery, and we will talk about that. We'll talk about that today. But I want to look first at the thing that I think in no small part has you out on the road, and that is you've got your paper book out of The Hornet's Nest, the novel you wrote, I think your 18th book, about the Revolutionary War. A character maybe from your own family's history plays a leading role here, a lot of action in the South. And it all left me wondering what it is about the Revolutionary War that most Americans don't know or don't pay attention to that may have motivated you to write about that period now.
Well, in the first place, I think that this is the most important conflict in which Americans were ever involved. It not only won our independence, but it shaped the character of our country for generations to come. The second reason I wanted to write about it is because it has been so sadly neglected. If you go to a library and look down the list of books about wars, you'll see hundreds about the Civil War and Vietnam and the First and Second World War, but very few about the Revolutionary War. And the third thing is there is so much misapprehension or misunderstanding about the Revolutionary War. If you ask the average history professor, what do you remember about the war, he would say, well, we fought some efforts to get into Canada. They were unsuccessful. There's some skirmishes fought around Boston. Paul Revere rode a horse in the middle of the night.
Yes, he did.
George Washington went across the Delaware in a snowstorm, and his troops had a bad time in New Jersey during the winter. And Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown. That's about it.
Simple as that.
Yeah. But the fact is that almost all the major wars that finally shaped the outcome of the conflict were fought in the South, with the British operating out of New York and up from St. Augustine, Florida. To retake Savannah and to retake Charleston and then to move through South and North Carolina into Virginia. And they were riding high and very likely to prevail in the overall war until Benjamin Franklin was successful, along with others, in getting a treaty with the French, which brought the French into the war in a very massive way. As a matter of fact, at Yorktown, when Cornwallis surrendered, the majority of the troops that fought against him were actually French. And for the first time, the French controlled the coastal area, having forced the British fleet back into New York for repairs. So the French and the Americans finally did prevail. But most of the war is the bloodiest aspect of it. And I would say some of the most torturous and difficult decisions were made in what we now know as the Deep South.
And Jimmy Carter, give us a sense of the story that you've teased out of this southern front of the war, the themes and the story that you've pulled up here.
Another thing is that it's hard for us to remember now that every settler, every colonist, was a loyal British subject. And over a period of a normal lifetime, in official commitments and in parties and birthdays and Christmas and so forth, there would be numerous oaths before God of loyalty to the king. There was no doubt about it. And even after the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia, quite late in the process, the leading Americans, George Washington, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and others, were still professing their complete loyalty to the British king. But one by one, because the British were so insensitive in abusing the colonists in a very unnecessary way, they precipitated an increasing animosity toward the king. and one by one within individual families. A senior son, for instance, would decide that he was going to take up weapons against his own government. And he would soon be fighting not against British troops, but against other Americans, mm-hmm. his father and his brothers.
His cousins,
mm-hmm. yeah. And so there was no... The remarkable thing about the Revolutionary War was, contrary to every other one we ever fought, there was no geographical division. We all know we fought in Vietnam, we fought in Korea, we fought in Europe in the First and Second World War. And in the Civil War, there was a Mason-Dixon line. If you lived north of it, you were probably a Yankee. If you lived south, you were a Confederate. But in the Revolutionary War, there was no such geographical division. The division was inside families and inside villages, where less than half of them, even at the end of the war, were fighting for independence, and still the majority of them, in almost every state, were still supporting the crown.
You are famously a Southerner, and an ancestor of yours is the model in some part
for the hero
of the Hornet's Nest. What role does that man play in the novel?
Ethan Pratt plays a major fictional role in the novel, but Ethan is based after what I have long known about my own family's history. The Carters first came over to this country about 1640 or 50 and settled around Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Later moved down to North Carolina. Were forced out of North Carolina by a despotic governor named Tryon and moved down to Georgia to the wilderness area or the Pioneer region, along with a group of Quakers, although they were not Quakers. My family were not
themselves.
Quakers.
Mm-hmm.
Themselves. So they lived there, but they had Quakerish inclinations. In fact, they did not want to go to war, and they didn't want to become involved in any sort of governmental intrigues. They lived by themselves. They wanted to be alone on their farms and raising their crops and animals. And it was only very reluctantly and over a long period of time that they eventually decided to take up weapons, primarily because Ethan Pratt's closest friend was assassinated by the British after he surrendered to the British, and because his only son was killed by an attack from British guerrillas. And it was then that he decided, I'm going to take up weapons and fight against these despotic people from London.
He went, Ethan Pratt, then going fully to war in Jimmy Carter's one and only novel.
That's right.
The Hornet's Nest.
To the horror of his wife, who was a deeply religious woman, whose father happened to have been a pastor, and whose main goal in life in moving to the frontier was to try to bring Christianity to the native Indians. So she was a pacifist herself, who, after Ethan went off to war, moved in and actually lived among the Quakers.
President Carter, novelist, we've got a passage here from your book, The Hornet's Nest, and this is where Ethan Pratt's wife, Epsi, finds their son, Henry, who has been killed by guerrillas, as you describe them. I wonder if you'd read a bit from the book for us.
Henry was a little boy, just a very few years old. Epsi abandoned her effort to catch the milk cow and began to move down the wooded lane toward the open fields and the cabin. She heard the sound of horses departing and then saw a column of rising smoke. She was terrified and ran as fast as possible, with a long skirt pulled up between her legs and clutched against her stomach. She could soon see that the cabin and outbuildings were all in flames, and she could not detect any movements around them. She glimpsed a small group of horsemen disappearing along the trail leading toward the Morris's cabin, and it seemed that there were at least two white men and the rest Indians. Epsi soon found the body of her son near the woodpile, horribly mutilated and scalped. For a long time she sat on the ground, holding Henry's lifeless body, hardly aware that she was drenched in his blood. She was overwhelmed with grief, which slowly changed to bewilderment and in anger at the war and everyone who was responsible for the violence. She was embarrassed to realize that she had even included Ethan, her husband, among those who were committing the repulsive acts. Finally, she was able to control her grief and rise and consider her own responsibilities. Almost everything that could be of value had been taken, and the men had rifled through all the personal belongings that had been neatly piled in the yard, waiting for the wagoner. First, she found a blanket in which she tenderly wrapped Henry's little body. Then she used an old shovel blade and dug a grave, deep enough to avoid any possible violation by scavenging animals. After a prayerful burial and the erection of a small marker, Epsi considered her plight and decided that she must go to Wrightsboro as quickly as possible for her own safety and to warn others about what she considered to be a war party. She walked carefully around the still smoldering cabin and tried to identify as many different footprints as possible. She was certain that there were at least three different white men and a much larger number of Indians, whose moccasin prints were indistinguishable from one another. Since they had taken a horse, she had no way to carry anything except on her back. Then she thought of the cow, returned to the woodland corral, soon had it roped, and brought it back to the cabin. She packed her most urgently needed things, draped them across the cow's back, and began the six-mile walk toward town.
Former President Jimmy Carter, novelist, reading from the new paperback edition of his book, The Hornet's Nest. Jimmy Carter, you're 80 now. You've got a lot under your belt in the military as President of the United States, a Nobel Prize winner. And yet, at the age of 80, you have really come out all guns blazing in this campaign season. There's a lot we want to talk about in that. You've said that nothing less than the nation's soul is at stake and may be at stake in this election. But before we move entirely away from this war and this time, I wonder, as you look back, people are looking back at the founders all the time, a very big theme. You looked at the war more broadly. I wonder if there are lessons about ourselves as Americans or about war, even this current war that we're in, that we might still profitably draw from that Revolutionary War experience.
I've thought about that a good bit since the war started in Iraq. First of all, most wars can be avoided, including the one in Iraq, in which we have now become embroiled as a quagmire. It was absolutely unjust war, and it was absolutely unnecessary war. It was based, as you know, on false statements, either deliberately false or twisting interpretations of intelligence. Most Americans were convinced, I think a majority of them were, that Iraq had massive weapons of mass destruction, that these weapons directly threaten the actual life and security of those of us who live over here in this country. And many Americans were convinced, because of misleading statements made, that Saddam Hussein somehow was responsible for 9/11. All of those premises on which this war was predicated have proven to be completely erroneous. And so, as was the case with this war, it could have been avoided had the British Parliament been just a little more sensitive to the legitimate interest of American colonists, it would have been no reason for the war.
I can hear a Bush supporter sitting tonight, Jimmy Carter, and saying to that, you know, that's just the problem. The American Revolution could have been avoided, but perhaps, but then we wouldn't have had the United States of America. We wouldn't have had the U.S. Constitution. We wouldn't have had the freedoms and the history that Americans are so proud of.
Well, actually, that's not true. We did have to go to war to defend our interests, but if you look at the rest of the British Empire over a period of years, all the original colonies have become independent. Canada is independent. Australia is independent. India is independent. And it would have been a while before America became independent, but I think we would have done it first because there was such an element of vitality and cohesion among these 13 colonies that didn't exist in Canada and India and Australia. So we would have become an independent nation regardless, in my opinion, not as early, but without the savagery of that war.
So war, capital W, are you saying, Jimmy Carter, better to avoid it even if the goal that you seek takes longer to produce in its absence, or that it's a better way to the goal, period?
I would say that the war, in every case, should be a last resort. I've devoted my life, since I left the White House, and to some degree before, I need to go into that, to trying to bring peace and freedom to other people. We've just completed holding our 52nd election in foreign countries. In every case, the election was in doubt.
Where the Carter Center was observing.
Right. And we would not have gone there if it had been an easy election. So we're dedicated to that. But we make our services available to people who are about to go to war and feel that they might avoid it, or to those already at war and are willing to let us try to bring a temporary ceasefire or even a peace. So that's still a premise of my life.
We're talking tonight with former President Jimmy Carter about Revolutionary War, about war on terror, about presidential politics. We recorded this conversation a couple of hours ago, so we're not taking calls tonight, but stay with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former President Jimmy Carter about the Revolutionary War, the war on terrorism, and the 2004 race for the White House. Jimmy Carter joins me in the studio. I want to look a little further at this issue of war and the commander-in-chief role. Many Americans, as we approach the November 2nd election, no small number, we can see from the polls, are very concerned about national security. Yes. They're very aware of the role that the commander-in-chief plays in a time of war. And, again, no small number will look and say, we need to support George Bush because we're in the middle of something here, and we've got to stand by our commander-in-chief. You spent longer in uniform than any American president other than Dwight Eisenhower, as far as I know. What about that view of the commander-in-chief in wartime, Jimmy Carter?
Well, that's a well-known premise in politics, both here and in other nations as well. It's a very politically attractive decision. When a beleaguered leader of a country who has this image of a prime minister who's dealing with taxation and welfare and health and transportation and education on the one hand, and who's involved in partisan conflicts, all of a sudden to abandon all that in the public's mind and become the commander-in-chief responsible for the safety and future of our own young men and women who are fighting overseas in a battle. And so immediately the popularity of that person skyrockets, as it did with George Bush Sr. in the first Gulf War. And also it becomes, if that leader is adroit politically and has some massive influence on the news media, it becomes almost traitorous to even criticize the judgment of that commander who took us into an unnecessary war. And so that's the main advantage that I see that George Bush still maintains, is that he is the commander-in-chief. Our country is involved in a conflict around the world with so-called terrorism, and we are bogged down in a war in Iraq, although unpopular and not trusted by the American people. They still feel that they ought to be loyal to the commander-in-chief, regardless of who he is.
So what do you say to the people who feel that way? You've been commander-in-chief yourself. You see the war the country's engaged in right now. What's your message to those people who feel that urge to loyalty?
Well, I think we ought to look to the future instead of look to the past. And we ought to see, does this president tell the truth? Have there been deliberately misleading statements made? Was it necessary for us to go to war? Are the best interests of American people still being maintained? Does the rest of the world give us at least tacit support or trust or confidence that our nation has always enjoyed? Does our nation still hold high the banner of basic human rights or civil rights? Those kind of questions need to be answered. And also, who could maybe do better? You know, I think there are two things that can be done, in my opinion, to bring about an early end to the quagmire in which we are deeply bogged down now in Iraq. One of those is ostentatiously and honestly to reach out to other countries, not just on a matter of come in and send your troops. That's just one facet of it. But come in and join us in the rebuilding of Iraq. Join us in economic matters. Share with us the responsibility for Iraq's oil in the future, which is a very difficult thing for the Bush administration to say.
To share.
Come and join us in shaping the political character of Iraq in the long term. And in the process, help us with a quick alleviation of the present constant violence. That's one thing that can be done, to be brief about it. The second thing is that this is the first administration since Israel was founded as a nation that is making no effort whatsoever to bring about a reconciliation between Israel and its neighbors. President Clinton did the best he could. George Bush Sr. did the best he could. All of the predecessors, all the way back to Eisenhower, have really tried hard under difficult political circumstances to have Israel and their neighbors have some intermediary who took a fairly balanced position, always supporting the security of Israel, but also reaching out to their adversaries and try to bring them together in a spirit of compromise and progress.
The sitting President Bush said it might be better to park that problem for a while.
He has parked it since he's been in office, and now you see the situation has completely been abandoned. There is no effort whatsoever being made now to find reconciliation between Israel and the Palestinians, or Israel and other neighbors.
And you're citing this as part of the way out of Iraq?
Yes.
Paint in the connection for us.
Well, I think that this is one of the two reasons why the rest of the world looks with such disfavor on us. The Pew Foundation is probably the best polling firm for international opinion. And they have found, for instance, in recent weeks, that even in the case of the two closest allies that the United States has had in the Arab world, Jordan and Egypt, who are looked upon as our friends, less than 5% of the people in both those nations now look with favor on the United States government and its policies. And one of the main reasons why there is a phalanx of condemnation of the United States and distrust of the United States, not just in the Arab world, but in Europe and other places, is because we have not been willing to make an honest attempt to protect the peace and I would say the justice of both Israelis and Palestinians simultaneously. This has been something that's been totally abandoned, and it is one of those reasons why we are so unpopular now and why there is so much animosity that has been aroused against our country. As you know, immediately after 9/11, we had almost unanimous support and approval and friendship and sympathy from every country almost in the world. And now we have lost that support.
You talk a lot about peace and have for many years. I wonder if the notion, the concept of peace is shifting, is changing in the United States. What do you think the American concept of peace, global peace, is today? And is it your concept of peace, Jimmy Carter?
Well, it's hard. It's hard to know. You've always got the choice of striving to maintain and promote peace on the one hand and looking on war as a last resort, or you've got the proposition, which is absolutely revolutionary in the last two or three years, of so-called preemptive war, where you deliberately announce to the rest of the world that we reserve the right to go to war against a country that doesn't even attack us or that doesn't even threaten our own security if we see fit. This has never been initiated before by anyone in Washington as a basic premise on which our nation's foreign policy was dependent, and that's quite a radical departure. So that sends a sense of consternation around the world, and it also alienates those nations who would normally be side by side with us in a concerted global effort to control terrorism. Now we're acting almost alone.
At the Democratic National Convention, we all understood that the word had gone out from the Democratic hierarchy. We're going to not be too harsh here. We don't want to look over the top. You came out just both guns blazing. You had a lot of really harsh criticism for the sitting administration.
Well, I thought it was a very modest and constructive speech.
Well, then the inner Jimmy Carter must really be mad. But you talked about this administration as an administration of extremism.
Yes.
Talked about the government's radical departure from the basic American principles and values. What do you mean when you make that critique, Jimmy Carter?
Well, I just described the one concerning war.
Preemptive war.
And the one concerning peace for other people. I would say another one that's been caused a lot of consternation here and around the world and for a transient period in the hearts and minds of a vast majority of Americans, and that is the abandonment of basic human rights I'm talking about human rights, or individual rights. After 9/11, and there may be some justification for this, inclination, but the administration in Washington, as you know, went around the country and arrested in the neighborhood of 1,500 or 1,600 Americans and put them in prison incommunicado without a charge being leveled against them and without that person's right to an attorney or even to see one's own family. That's an unprecedented thing in the history of our country, and it was deplored and is now being challenged successfully, by the way, in the federal courts in a very slow and tedious way. The second thing that we did was to take prisoners that we captured in Afghanistan and put them in Guantanamo, as you know, 600 or 700 of them, I've forgotten exactly why, without charges against them, without attorneys, and without the ability to communicate with their families. Those were direct and dramatic deviations from the basic principles of our country. And, of course, the other thing was the prison debacle, when some public statements made by the Secretary of Defense and the Vice President and others insinuated, at least, that the so-called Geneva Convention rights of prisoners were no longer applicable in a time of terrorism. And I don't think that was a direct order, but it certainly gave a permissive attitude where a few aberrant people could attack and disgrace our country and the people that they were trying to protect in prison.
You're clearly upset about these things. You're shouting about them. You're also watching the American people. How are you assessing the American people's response to these developments? I mean, clearly there are people who have protested, people who have spoken out about it, but many others who have not. Do we have a self-riding electorate, a self-riding population? Are you confident that the United States government will stay lined up over those core American principles you've described?
In the long term, yes. In the long term, we've done that for 220 years or so. But it would be very difficult now to have the Congress approve the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights.
It'd be difficult now because?
People don't really have very much concern about protecting those basic rights.
You're saying that the political climate has changed. The members of Congress would not be prone to do so.
Exactly.
That's a pretty astonishing statement.
Well, it's true, though. The idealistic nature of Thomas Jefferson and others, who were so deeply committed to liberty and freedom and the autonomy of individuals and the high principles of our country, those things have been put into some great degree of doubt right now. And there's not an outpouring of consternation about what has been done to those 1,500 people that I described to you, those 600 at Guantanamo. And we've been through this phase before. As one of the most notable examples was after the Civil War. We spent 100 years laboring under the misguided legal principles of so-called separate but equal as it dealt to segregation, where it was okay to have separate schools. It was all right to have separate bus stations. It was all right to make blacks sit in the back of a train. It was all right to deprive black people from the right to vote because of poll taxes. It was all right to deprive black people of a chance to serve on juries.
But are you saying 9/11 could kick us into another 100-year detour?
I don't think so. I think it's a much more temporary thing than that. I think it'll be corrected very soon because we now have one major instigation of public and widespread condemnation from many other countries in the world. And we now have the United Nations and other agencies of that kind to say these are the principles of basic human rights that have prevailed for a long time. This is an aberration now.
The polls are very close. Everything seems to be within the margin of error. But nevertheless, in most of the polls, George Bush is a bit ahead. What do you make of the presidential race this year? How it's going with 2 weeks to go?
I don't keep up with it all that closely. I don't have any way to do so and not involved in partisan politics directly. But I don't think there's any doubt that a month ago, before the debates, George Bush was a runaway leader, 15 points ahead in some polls and that sort of thing. And with the advent of the three debates, when the two men were on together, I think that most polls showed that Kerry prevailed in all three debates. And now, as you say, it is neck and neck. I don't know how it's going to come out. But I think one of the strongest impressions that I have is a deep division of Americans who have almost unshakable commitments on both sides. There's not very much flexibility or doubtful arena of voters left. And the other thing, which I think is very good, is the intensity of interest in this coming election. The number of viewers for the debates was
pretty high.
Surprisingly high, and the number of new voters who are trying to register for November election is extremely high.
What do you make of that famously deep division in American politics today? Why is it there? Is it so different than what we've seen in the past? And if so, what is driving it?
Part of what's driving it is what we mentioned earlier, and that is the intensity of negative advertising. In the times when I ran for office, we never had any negative advertising. It would have been suicidal to put forward any sort of condemnation of one's opponent.
There was just no appetite for it.
No, and the American public would have condemned it. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, it's an accepted thing. And this intense commitment on the part of both sides, I'm not blaming either side, to the exclusion of the other, to destroy the basic reputation and integrity of an opponent, usually with false or misleading allegations, is something new. And it's hard for us to realize how new that is.
But can this polarization simply be the result of the way Americans are addressed in campaign ads every four years?
I think that's one of the things that's evolved. But you have to remember that that's a fairly new development. Mm-hmm. It hasn't always been the case. And when once the election is over and certain Democrats and Republicans have won or lost, and then the victors go to Washington, the division inside the U.S. Congress and inside the U.S. Senate is unprecedented. All you have to do is talk to anybody who's been there for a few years and ask them to look back 20 years or 10 years and see what is the difference. And they say it is a much much greater sharp division on a partisan basis than we've ever seen before.
So stand in the middle of that chasm, if you will, Jimmy Carter. Look at each side and tell us what you see there today on the Democrat side, on the Republican side. If we've got this great polarized nation, what is driving each side? What are the very disparate, I guess, motivations?
Well, I think more and more the Republican Party has become aligned with the extremely rich. And that has been the case for generations. That's not something new. On a general, there are exceptions in both ways. And the Democrats in general have been for the poorer and more deprived working class people. I think that's been historically true. That's one part of it.
But the extremely rich are only 1 or 2% of the population. They get a much bigger vote than that.
That's true. But another aspect of that is how the nation has come to be divided on a religious basis. In the past, we've always believed on absolute and total separation of church and state. It was exemplified more than any other time when John Kennedy ran for president. He reavowed the premise on which our founding fathers had based this nation's principles. That is, there's no interrelationship between a church and the political campaign or between an incumbent who's successful in espousing or promoting his own faith in preference to others. Nowadays, there's no doubt that the Republican Party and the right-wing or conservative Christians have gone to bed together. This is well known. I don't think anyone would doubt that. And that's been a change. Another change that's taken place is the remarkable abandonment by the Republican Party of a justified reputation for fiscal integrity, fiscal responsibility. Where we see now that under Bill Clinton's administration, you had enormous surpluses and a very careful husbanding of our nation's financial resources. Now, of course, we have the worst deficit in history, and the Republicans have no compunction at all about voting for massive giveaways to all political groups without any compensating income increase through taxation or any sort of husbanding of resources. So that's something new that I've never seen before.
We're talking tonight with former President Jimmy Carter. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former President Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, you were talking before the break about the rise in the alliance of the evangelical Christian community and the Republican Party. You were maybe the first born-again American president. I don't know if I've got my history exactly right there. George Bush, of course, also cites his relationship with his religion as central and had a midlife experience that brought him much more close, aligned him much more closely there. But in 1976, when you ran for president and won, if I got my history right, you probably had a preponderance of the evangelical vote to the extent that that was identified in those days. Why do you think that vote now sits in the Republican camp?
Well, that's not exactly true. I can't dispute everything you said. But when I was elected, for instance, the Southern Baptist Convention, in which I was played a major part, I was a leader in it, was basically controlled by a mixture of conservatives and progressives or moderates that had been extant ever since this nation was founded. Mm. It was only in 1979, after I had been president for 2 or 3 years, that the right-wing or conservative members of the Southern Baptist Convention took charge of it. And now it's almost exclusively very conservative, and the moderates and liberals have been pushed out of the convention. So So, and that was, the moral majority was never known. I don't think even the phrase was used before 1976 when I ran for president. So that change has been made. I consider myself an evangelical. If an evangelical is one who has Christian beliefs and wants to spread your beliefs to other people, you know, through the demonstration, through words and actions of the life and message of Jesus Christ.
But is it inevitable or natural or somehow preordained that the evangelical community in the United States be aligned with the conservative party in the United States?
I don't think it's inevitable or preordained, but it certainly has happened.
And why?
Well, I don't know. I can't explain exactly why it has occurred, but there's no doubt that it's a fact. And I look on the Christian faith. I'm reluctant to talk about this even on radio, but as being the exemplification of the words and actions of Jesus Christ, who I think was committed to principles that are not discussed in the religious arena these days. I worship the Prince of Peace, not war. And I looked on his premises as one that profoundly promotes the avoidance of war if there is any possible alternative to the killing of other people on the battlefield or from missiles or bombs dropped on innocent people. I think that's a premise of Jesus Christ. I look on Christ also as having been the proponent and the exemplar of reaching out to the poor, the despised, the forgotten, the ignored, the suffering people of the world, and not to the wealthy or dominant political or economic element of society. Jesus reached out to the scorned. The Samaritans were so horribly scorned that their shadow on the foot of a devout Jew would keep that person from going to worship until they were cleansed. Mm. He exalted the Samaritans. He embraced and kissed lepers, who might be equivalent in modern-day terms to those who suffer from AIDS. He embraced the sinful, the scorned, the tax collectors who abandoned their own people and took up money for the Romans, and he went home and had supper with them and so forth. So, and I think that another premise, and this is the last thing I'll do to abbreviate my answer, is I think we are all stewards of God's world, and a human being has a duty, not only a right, but a duty to protect the environment as much as possible, to make sure that each succeeding generation has a better place in which to live than what we inherited. Those are the kind of things that I equate with some basic Christian principles.
But President Bush describes faith as being, maybe more than any president, certainly in my memory, at the center of his presidency, of his stewardship of that job. He is quoted as describing himself as called upon by God to do this job. What do you make of the president's, the way that the president carries his religion in office and its meaning for the presidency?
I don't want to comment on that because I don't have any reason to doubt the total sincerity of President Bush's religious faith. Departing from him personally, now, though, there are two basic markers that have been exalted above everything else. One is homosexuality.
By marker, you mean a point of distinction between the parties?
How to treat gays. Mm-hmm. So far as I know, Jesus Christ never mentioned homosexuality. I'm sure he didn't, as a matter of fact. But he mentioned adultery, and he mentioned selfishness, and he mentioned all other kinds of things. And I think that's a very important issue. And the other one is abortion. I personally have a problem with abortion. I cannot believe that Christ would have favored abortion, unless perhaps the mother's life would have been in danger. This was the biggest problem I had, morally speaking, when I was president.
Bring unto me the little children.
That's right. But I was sworn to uphold the Constitution of the United States as interpreted under Roe versus Wade. But I think those two issues are the ones that now have been almost totally equated to the abandonment of everything else, with whether you are or not a devout Christian, and I don't think that's a proper measure.
Let me ask you about another subject. As a Southerner, it would appear, looking back on American presidential votes in recent years, that Northerners are willing to vote for Southerners to be president. But Southerners are not very inclined to vote for Northerners. And I don't know what we'll see this time, but there's a Texan in this race, and there's a New Englander, and we'll see how it turns out. What is that about? Is that an eternal factor now in American presidential politics? Must it be this way?
Well, I think most people equated George Bush Sr. With New England.
He loved to go for the chitlins and claim the Texas adopted home.
Whether that was sincere or not, I don't know.
Right.
But of course, his son has now adopted Texas as his home. So I wouldn't want to argue about the geographical part. I remember the first time I came to Boston to campaign in 1975, I went out to one of the historic Revolutionary War sites, and I couldn't get anybody to go out with me but one television crew. There were two people, one on the camera and the other one asking me a question. And they said, why in the world would anybody from Massachusetts vote for a Georgian for president? And I said, well, let me answer this way. When John Kennedy ran for president, he got a greater percentage of votes in Georgia than he did in Massachusetts. And I expect the Massachusetts folks to do the same thing for me.
Turnabout's fair
and they
play.
Did, as a matter of fact. Massachusetts went for me. So
sure.
I think that you know, geographical delineation is probably a superficial issue. I don't think it's that folks are for or against John Kerry or for or against George Bush just because of what state they happen to come from.
You were saying earlier the Carter Center has monitored elections in some 52 countries around the world, recently in Mozambique and Venezuela,
yes.
Indonesia. In less than 2 weeks now, we're going to have an election right here in this country, and you have expressed some pretty high concern about exactly how those elections will be carried out and the possibility for credibility problems. What are your concerns as we sit here today?
Well, I think the Florida election was an embarrassment and a debacle.
In 2000.
And we need not go into detail about that. But I'm afraid that we might see similar occurrences around this country in two more weeks. We monitor these elections all over the world. Some of them are third world countries, but their elections compared to the United States are superb. Ours are heavily faulted in a number of key respects. One is that we don't go into another country unless all the qualified candidates have equal access to public television and radio.
You won't even show up unless that's the basic
That's correct.
Condition.
Mm-hmm. In this country, if you can't raise $100 million,
mm-hmm.
you have very little chance of becoming the nominee of the Republican or Democratic Party these days. Mm-hmm. And you have to buy your way in through television primarily into the right to present your case to the public in the campaign. That's different. Another thing is that we don't go into another country to monitor the election unless there is a central election commission that's trusted reasonably well and is bipartisan or nonpartisan in nature. In Florida, still, as you know, the Secretary of State is a highly partisan activist Republican who was not elected but was appointed by the governor of Florida, who happens to be the president's brother.
And, of course, in 2000, it was Catherine Harris, who was co-chair of the Bush-Cheney state campaign
exactly.
in Florida.
And she was ostentatiously biased. I mean, even her public statements, she never professed to be unbiased. And the third thing is there has to be a uniformity of opportunity for people all over the country to vote. In the United States, unfortunately, we have about 4,400 different kinds of authorities to promulgate to vote in individual counties. And Florida has 67 different counties. So they're quite different. And the courts have ruled, I don't know if it's too late or not, but the courts have ruled in Florida you've got to have a way with touchscreen voting to have a recount if there's a very close and disputed election.
Okay.
That has not yet been guaranteed. The last election that we monitored was in a country that had touchscreen voting, but every time you voted, you also got a paper ballot, and you could look at the ballot and make sure that the machine recorded your vote the same way that the paper said. And then you put the paper in the ballot box, and where there was a dispute, you could get out the paper ballots and count them and see if it was accurate or not. Why doesn't our country do that all over? We don't have any uniformity around this country. So it's a very deeply faulted system. After Florida in 2000, President Gerald Ford and I were asked to head up a commission of about 50 prominent Democrats and Republicans, half and half, and we came out with unanimous recommendations on how our system could be improved. And in most cases, those recommendations have not been implemented.
Jimmy Carter, just a couple final things. One, the global test that John Kerry spoke of, that he said the United States should take into consideration before it goes to war. He's been pummeled for this by George Bush, saying we should never put our national security in the hands of any other nation, any other capital. What do you make of this idea of the global test? Does it line up with the Jimmy Carter view of the world?
Well, if you look at what John Kerry actually said, and instead of what the Republicans said, he said, this is quite a different premise. What he made clear, and he said it without equivocation, was that he would never turn over any responsibility for the security of this country to any other foreigner, the United Nations or any other foreign country. That's the bottom line. But he did say that when we make decisions in the future, we want our decision to be so honest and explained so truthfully that other nations around the world will have confidence in the United States and in the United States policies, as they have had down through history. I think that's a very reasonable commitment to make, and I hope that we'll see that implemented.
We've just got a couple of minutes here, but I want to ask you, you said at the Democratic Convention that there is nothing less at stake in this political season than the nation's soul. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, for the last half hour or so, we've been talking about those kind of things. I would say a commitment to peace, unless war is unavoidable. I would say a commitment to the basic principles of human rights, not only for ourselves, but the promotion of those human rights around the world. I would say to transparency in the conduct of our policies and the truthfulness with which our basic domestic and foreign policies are promulgated to Americans and around the world. I would say a proper commitment by government to the kinds of people in America who need government services most and who need to be protected from the powerful and the rich. Those are the kind of things that I see as being very important. Another principle that I think is crucial, and I can't assign any partisan responsibility for this, is to start healing the deep division that now has this country so divided. I don't remember, at least in my lifetime of 80 years, ever seeing this country so highly partisan and so sharply divided and with these partisan divisions filled with so much vituperation or actual personal animosity than they are now.
Are you confident the country's turning a corner on that or not?
I believe so. I think it's going to – I have optimism that in all three or four of these things that I just outlined, that there's going to be a better day ahead of us.
Jimmy Carter, wonderful talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us. Former President Jimmy Carter. For more on the president, including an excerpt of his Revolutionary War novel, The Hornet's Nest, go to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.